You know the senator. I feel that I should not introduce him to you, but rather that I should introduce you to him. Mr. Senator, I present to you members of VEM and their friends who look forward to hearing your words of meaning.
Mr. Niles and members of the Business Executives Association and friends, I don't know whether I should take credit or not for the President's having changed the date of his State of the Union message. I'm somewhat suspicious. I was scheduled to be on the cover of Newsweek 3 weeks ago, and we suspect that the administration forced the devaluation of the pound in order to replace me on that. And more recently, I was displaced on the cover of Life by a photograph of one of the hearts that failed. That was going somewhat too far also. I couldn't blame that on the administration, however. I think they were somewhat removed from that. So in any case, tonight when I had to make the hard choice of canceling this and hearing the State of the Union message and appearing here with you, I should say what might have been a hard choice, it was not, it was an easy choice, and I'm glad to be here with you. Especially since, as I don't say I've provided any leadership, because the movement of which I've become a part in a kind of accidental concentration of interest, I think, was in a way, I don't say there before me, but many of us moved along the way of disillusionment and beyond the point of patience with the presentation of the case for our war in Vietnam, and we reserved the harsh judgment upon it as long as we could, accepting for several years in 63 and 64 the promise that we were providing just one limited component out of which would come a stable society in South Vietnam, anticipating that our military commitment would be over in 1964, and then later accepting that our troops would be home in 1965. And at each stage of the increase in our military commitment, our physical commitment, there came a kind of escalation also of objectives, a kind of ideological escalation to somehow justify the increased military commitment. Until finally, in October of this year, the Secretary of State began to talk about the threat to America of 1 billion Chinese armed with nuclear weapons. That the kind of ultimate escalation, it seemed to me, in terms of the objective of the war. But I know that those of us who are here, most of us, did not have to wait until October of last year. But I think in the case of most of us, the point at which we were satisfied that this was no longer a defensible war must have come somewhere in the year 1966, when the war in Vietnam became our war, and when, in fact, South Vietnam became a captive country for the United States. And since that time, although the administration still talks about the good that will come with victory, the fact is that we have now all the problems of victory, a country dependent upon us, one in which almost every structure has been destroyed, its economic structure, its social fabric, its culture, its political structure, if it had any, and even its military structure, so that we have, in effect, a complete dependency, yet we're not permitted to even talk about negotiation unless somehow we have the approval of General Chu or of General Key. Well, it was difficult as we went along this way to find people to support us publicly. Individuals would speak out, but I was more concerned about, categories of Americans who were free or disposed to speak out on an issue of this kind. Because in a way, it was a very difficult challenge. For the first time in our history, we're called upon to speak not with regret over something that might have been wrong that our nation did, and not with the confidence of victory and having accomplished something very good, but to look at one of our actions in mid-course, to pass a judgment upon it, to determine that what we were doing was right or wrong, and on the basis of that determination, to take some kind of practical action. At least not in in the recent history of the United States have we been called upon to face up to this kind of decision. We are called upon it, and have been called upon it, to do this for at least 1 year and a half. And I think we must give credit to the students of America. I believe that they were the first to speak out freely and openly. And along with them, some of the academic profession, particularly the scientists who are in such demand today that they're under no real restraint. And following that, of course, as we expected, the artists and the writers, and then I suppose the women of America, who stood up more freely and more courageously than the men. A few politicians, a few retired military officers. And finally, I don't say finally because I expect more to come, but with some courage and determination, the businessmen of America began to speak out. And this was not in consequence, I'm sure, of their being afraid they'd be called merchants of death or that they might be charged with being part of the great industrial, military, financial complex that's been spoken about. Not because, as is true, war is no longer very necessary to stimulate the American economy, but because they passed a genuine and an honest judgment with reference to the American involvement in the war in Vietnam. And here tonight you have the men who took the initiative and the leadership. And it required some boldness and some commitment on their part. 20 years ago, Gilbert Chesterton, writing about America, said that every time we had a difficult problem, he said, someone says that what you need is a practical man. And he said, unfortunately, there were always two or three available. His conclusion then was that there were some problems with which a practical man could not offer very much. In this case, we need theorists and historians and philosophers and poets and students and politicians, but we do need and have here the sustaining support of men who are recognized as passing hard and practical judgment in the business and in the financial world, and in this case, they're transferring that same method and that same disposition to the field of politics. And the action of this businessmen's committee, I think, has done as much or more than that of any other group to cause the country, and it will continue to cause the country, to pause and to re-examine this course of the United States of America. Well, what are the costs of the war? They're difficult to measure because they're reflected in every area of our responsibility and of our effort. There are moral costs, there are human costs, there are physical costs. We do have some senators who can give you an estimate of the moral state of the United States on rather short notice, a kind of power to read spirits and make a projection of it. And I would not attempt to do that, but I think there can be no question but what the involvement in this war has done more to cause moral uneasiness, distress and anxiety in this country than any international involvement, at least in our entire history. And I'm inclined to think that the judgment which Charles Peguy expressed at the time of the Dreyfus case in France may have great application to us. But he said at that time that no single crime, if it is given public support and public approval, is made somehow official, can do anything except to destroy the social fabric and bring guilt upon an entire nation. He was speaking of a single act of injustice. And we're called upon in this nation now to give approval and endorsement and support not to one single act of injustice, but to a multitude of such acts. And if his judgment was right, as I think it was, in a separate and individual and very particular case, then we must pause to try to assess and measure our own moral guilt with reference to the involvement in Vietnam itself. There's been an erosion of the processes of democracy in this country. And I may seem to overstate the case, but I do think this is a most serious consideration. In the name of unity and in opposition to dissent, politicians are charged with being disloyal or on the verge of being disloyal if they raise a question against the war. And the old words that we thought were at least we hope, were gone for one generation that many of us experienced back in 1948 and 50 and on through 56. Suggestion of subversion if you did not give full support to national policy. Words like nervous Nellies and knee-jerk liberals and crypto-communists, that whole great litany of names has begun to come back into currency. And it's coming back in this year of 1968 and in last year, 1967, not just from those whom we would expect to use this language, but from some of it whom we thought spoke our own language 10 or 12 years ago. A field commander is brought back to the United States to give a political address before a joint session of Congress, confusing the processes and the lines of distinction that must be protected in a democracy. In contrast, I might say, with the way in which Harry Truman used or did not use General MacArthur, General Westmoreland used to support a political position. The Tonkin Gulf Resolution, designed and planned for presentation, quite clearly to set limits upon the freedom of Congress to pass later judgment or even current judgment upon a national issue. In contrast with the now known refusal of Harry Truman to send a Korean resolution to Congress because he accepted that it was his responsibility, that he had a clear legal and constitutional obligation to carry on that war. The use of wage price guidelines and a kind of price fixing arrangement, which if it had not been performed in the White House would have been illegal, a kind of revival of the old British system of bringing in the barons and letting them agree to anything in the presence of the king and then go back home. And I must say the businessmen were somewhat at fault. I think a lot of them like to act like barons. They rather feel pleased to be brought into the castle and asked to sit down around the round table and kind of concur in these illegal acts and go back home feeling that they somehow are superior. But in contrast with the Truman approach to the problem of steel, when he announced he was going to take them over and went to the Supreme Court in order to have that particular issue settled, a keeping clear of the lines of responsibility and of authority with no confusion and no erosion. In this last session of Congress, in part because of this approach to problems, the administration lost control of the two committees which I think any administration must have today in order to really conduct the affairs of government. One, the Ways and Means Committee in the House of Representatives, upon which it must depend for tax policy, and the other, the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate. Now, it may seem that there have been some superficial victories over that committee, but only on old issues. As new problems have come and new demands have been made with reference to foreign policy, the lack of support, the lack of cooperation, the lack of a common cause is between that committee, on which a majority of the Democrats and a majority of the entire committee disagree with policy in Vietnam, has shown through very clearly and very consistently. In addition to that, there has been a general neglect of our other responsibilities, both at home and abroad. Now, the Secretary of Defense some time ago said we could afford to conduct two wars like the war in Vietnam. I don't know what his views are now. I think that he was wrong then. I don't think we can afford to conduct one war like the war in Vietnam. Certainly our national security is not at stake. Our national honor has not been pledged in that war. And certainly our influence or our future as a force for good and influence in the world does not, in my mind, depend upon what seems to be the administration's definition of victory in South Vietnam. The economic consequences are becoming increasingly clear. A balance of payments crisis, which we are attempting to meet with rather improvised propositions and with proposals which in both the short and the long run cannot be good for the United States and cannot be good for the economies of the other nations of the world. The British pound in trouble at a time when the pound is really more important east of Suez than the British Army or the British Navy. I see the British have recognized that today and are going to try to strengthen the pound at the cost of their military presence in most of Asia. I think this action has been slow in coming, and in part has been slow in coming because our administration was urging them to maintain a military presence in Asia and in the Far East. Inflation at home running over 3%, directly attributable to the increased cost of the war in Vietnam and the failure of the administration either to anticipate those costs, or if it did anticipate them, to propose the necessary stringent fiscal actions that would bring about control of inflation. Essential needs of our society being neglected. And most of this neglect in the so-called Great Society, the new programs needed to strengthen those who are least able to help themselves in America. The budget in 1967 providing only $1 billion of increase for these essential needs at a time when the defense budget was being increased by $25 to $30 billion. And I don't want to take anything away from the State of the Union message, which is being given at this time, but essentially the same kind of limitation upon expenditures for essential domestic programs is being proposed at this very time in the capital of the United States. Fiscal 1968, the five key departments and agencies dealing with the social needs of this nation were given only $5 billion. In contrast with defense expenditures, which will run very close to $80 billion. Something like four out of five of every federal dollar being spent somehow on defense, and of that, between $25 and $30 billion being spent in Vietnam itself. Well, I say all of these costs, the moral costs, the economic costs, the political costs here at home, the social losses, and the fact that in all of this we have lost our position of influence and of leadership in the world, all of these taken together would be enough if we were simply, we'd say, hard-hearted and practical politicians. If we approach this only in terms and within the framework of the harshest Machiavellian principles, one would have to say that the pursuit of this war is not in the national interest of America. And that would be enough in itself, because the national interest is an overriding concern, and in a kind of quantitative way, it takes on moral significance too. We can step aside from this kind of framework of judgment and pass a kind of independent and strict moral judgment upon our involvement in the war in Vietnam. To ask the question as to, first of all, whether we can justify our objectives in that country and in that war. And if we accept as a stated objective the security of the United States, as is suggested by the administration, we must reject it as being entirely irrational and therefore unacceptable. How anyone can propose that the nation should believe that we are in danger, that our national security is directly or indirectly involved in Vietnam, is to test the trust of this nation beyond any reason or any limit. We must pass a harsh moral judgment upon it in terms of the methods and the instruments of war which we are using. It's not been in the tradition of this country to use sophisticated weapons or our great power against backward and underdeveloped and primitive nations. The fact is that this is what we are doing in South Vietnam and in North Vietnam. This, the nation which raised the greatest cry and has been most consistent in opposing the use of poison gas, now under suspicion of using a gas which it's reported is not 100% lethal, 10% with adults and 90% with children. The nation which has given approval to the use of napalm, a rather sophisticated instrument of war against simple people. A nation which in war has come to realize what we once thought of as in terms of horror, kind of Orwellian horror. Back in 1946, Orwell writing about the Russian suppression of the Hungarian peasants said that what a nation does when it's in trouble is to develop a Latin word that will cover a multitude of horrors. And he described the word pacification in 1946. He said, this is the word that describes what happens when people are driven out of a village, when their cattle are machine gunned, and their thatched houses set on fire, all in the name of something called pacification. The word that we are called to live with today is escalation. A frightening word in this sense that it seems to leave us free from any kind of moral responsibility and even destroys the possibility of our passing a kind of intellectual judgment at any one point. Because if you say this is the point at which you ought to stop, they say, well, either we haven't reached it yet or it's too late. We've already passed it. And so both the intellectual and the moral judgment are denied to us as we as a nation stand apart trying to pass a judgment on the objectives and also on the methods and instruments of this war. And finally, we cannot accept it or approve it by applying the prudent standard of proportion. And to make a war defensible and justifiable, this standard must apply. And you apply it, I think, by saying, is the good that will come with victory, whatever that good may be, in any way proportionate to the harm that is the cost of that victory, to the loss of lives, to the loss of wealth, to the destruction of culture and society and order in the world? And I think that we have long passed the point at which, by this rather simple standard, but nonetheless important historical standard, our involvement in Vietnam could be justified, and certainly we have passed the point at which it can be justified. What we attempt to do in the activities of this organization and what others of us are trying to do by somewhat different means is, first of all, to call upon this nation to pass this judgment and at the same time to undertake to rearrange the priorities which are set for this nation both at home and also abroad, and to accept that our role really is not to police the planet, that the gift which America has to give to the world is not the gift of military strength, but rather the gift of ideas and the gift that comes with a great commitment of intellect and will toward solving the problems of all people in all times. And what we're really called upon today to do is to respond to the first test of America in history, to demonstrate that our ideas and our institutions and our achievements are not limited goods for a limited number of people, not just for the people of Western civilization, but that these taken all together, what in a somewhat uncritical way we call our way of life, offers the best hope and the best way for all men in all places at all times, and that this good will be achieved not through strength of arms, but through the strength of spirit, through the strength of intellect, and through the strength of will. We're called upon to look to the problems of the world, to pass a judgment upon them, and then following that to make a commitment. And I would conclude with this observation, that the first responsibility of a nation at home and also abroad is the pursuit of justice. And if we pursue justice and achieve it in some measure, then peace will take care of itself. Thank you.
Senator, we certainly thank you for coming out tonight, talking to us. Well, I know that there's another place that you were Not wanted. I'm sure that all of us enjoyed hearing you. And I think while I'm at it, I should also thank all these people who have come and given us the support in putting this dinner over tonight. I should also say that any of you businessmen who want to join with what the rest of us are doing, see most any of us who are active, and we'll get you cards and so forth. As a matter of fact, there are cards in the back.
Also to carry on the war. I think there are two weaknesses in that. One is that I don't think we ought to be doing what we're doing in the war. But the second is that the proposals that he makes in the State of the Union message are not adequate to accomplish to win or even to advance significantly the second war. Not a question of whether the country can, but whether or not the administration and the Congress together will take the action which is necessary to do both things. And I don't think they will or can.
I'm sorry, Senator. The tenor of the message seemed to be that the country is moving along on both fronts. And earlier you said it was an objective report.
Well, I think what it is. He did report it was moving, but it's not moving nearly fast enough. I don't say there's been no progress, but certainly the progress with reference to domestic problems has been too slow. And the programs which are suggested in the message are wholly inadequate to make the kind of progress we need. Even in the field of housing, what's proposed in the administration is short of what we need to go very far beyond simply holding even as housing needs in the country increase because of increased population, because of the deterioration of existing housing.
How about the jobs proposal?
Well, the jobs proposal is a good proposal. This was one which was made this year in Congress, and we pushed it without the support of the administration this year. I hope they do support it next year.
What about his gold policy, Senator?
Well, the gold policy is one that others have been recommending for at least 2 years. I think it's a proposal which he should have made. It's not one that's going to solve the balance of payments problems immediately. And it doesn't really tie in with the negativism of the recommendations which have been made with reference to cutting down American investments overseas. So it's a kind of a contradictory proposal for the administration to make.
Well, do you think in view of this proposal that perhaps Congress will not legislate in accordance with his investment recommendations?
Oh, I don't know. I think we ought to take the gold cover off immediately, no matter what we do about the other proposals.
Senator McCarthy, on your own campaign, there have been a whole slew of articles recently suggesting you're not exciting enough. You agree with that, or why aren't you more exciting?
I don't know what you want me to do. I was rather encouraged tonight. A number of people after my speech tonight said, we don't really understand what the columnists have been saying about how negative and dull and unexciting you are. So I said, well, I'm rather pleased that they built up that image. Now, I used to be compared with the Stevenson speech, and I was always a disappointment. They say you're not as exciting as you once were. Now they say you're much more exciting than we expected you to be, so I've been helped somewhat by that representation.
Senator, would you consider this the fact that you didn't attend tonight in the chamber, would you call this a snub?
I don't think so. I was committed to speak here. I suppose someone will call it a snub. I didn't do it with that intention. I was committed to make this speech two or three weeks ago before I knew when the State of the Union message was to be given. We talked some with trying to advance the program here tonight so I could go, but weren't able to do it. So that it's one of those accidents that
Senator,
coincidental.
Senator, by contrast with the last four State of the Union messages, the President said almost nothing tonight, or very little, about Vietnam. To what do you attribute this?
Well, as I said earlier, I thought it was a modest and a restrained statement with reference to achievements, and that what he reported by way of achievement in Vietnam, I think, is probably quite objective. There may be some overstatement with reference to the number of people who are now under government protection, but other than that, it was a very restrained statement about the war in Vietnam. The statement that we are winning more battles. What a victory in a battle there means is somewhat hard to define. But I find no fault in terms of the claims which were made with reference to the war in Vietnam.
Senator McCarthy, do you see any conditions?
You. Okay. Senator, let's say, hanging in there has brought some movement in Hanoi's position, why not hang in a while longer?
Well, I don't know that it has brought any movement. The position, as far as I know, of Hanoi is essentially the same now as it was in 1966, when they indicated that they were willing to negotiate. So far as their position is concerned of being willing to negotiate, I don't see it as being any different now from what it was. And we don't have any very clear statement of their being willing to make any concessions that are very different from those which they proposed, or at least supposedly held to in 1966.
Senator, as a member of the Finance Committee, could you explain to us what you think the lifting of the gold cover will do?
Sorry. Well, the lifting of the gold cover, it seems to me, should be a signal to the rest of the world that we are prepared to lose gold if instead of gold we can get some significant investments in foreign countries, that we would rather have investment and economic progress in foreign countries than to hoard $4 or $5 billion worth of gold in Fort Knox. It seemed to me it'd be an indication of rationality and of optimism on the part of the United States, both of which it would seem to me would be encouraging to any nation that was looking to us.
Senator, do you see any conditions under which you might withdraw your candidacy?
Well, I could imagine some. I mean,
would it be, sir?
I don't see any realistic possibilities of my withdrawal. But
what if we stop?
Is your imagination broad enough to consider perfect peace and order in the world? Why, I say I could imagine that, but I don't see it coming.
What if we stop the bombing unconditionally, sir, and
talks get underway? No, I don't see that. No, I'd have to see what they were willing to negotiate and what progress towards negotiation, towards objectives which I think are the only realistic ones upon which some kind of order can be achieved.
Senator, here you are, here's the President on national television, and here you are in a hotel ballroom to 250 people at the same time. How does this make you feel about your presidential campaign?
Well, I'm on television now, and your networks, I expect I'm reaching out. I hope these are not dead cameras. If they are, I've been taken in. I'm sorry, man.
Thank you, sir. I'm not even going to keep picking up Robert King.
Just